Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And what is said behind closed doors, we're going to think about that this hour, is number one, statements out of context and nobody else's business. Or number two, the real truth and words people need to be held accountable for. Well, two examples of that this hour. The candor of bankers was revealed this week by the Federal Reserve as the dramatic minutes of the Federal Reserve during the worst of the financial crisis tell a story of some cool heads and smart choices. We'll talk about that positive story later this hour, but a positive story is not the conclusion one naturally draws from the Justice Department's critical report on the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department. Even though the DOJ said it would not file federal civil rights charges against shooter Darren Wilson in the Michael Brown case, instead, in 105 scathing pages, the DOJ makes the argument that the Ferguson police were in a racist bubble of their own making, a deeply rooted culture of bias and prejudice that affected who it arrested and how it treated the citizens it was supposed to protect. Now, listen to these highlights. And I know you might be thinking, Ferguson, okay, you can tune out. Well, these are really, really crucial. Listen to this. 90% of documented force used by FPD officers was used against African Americans. In every canine bite incident for which racial information is available, the person bitten was an African American. A November 2008 email, sort of behind closed doors station house humor here, stated that President Barack Obama would not be president for very long because what black man holds a steady job for 4 years? A June 2011 email described a man seeking to obtain welfare for his dogs, this is a joke apparently, because they are mixed in color, unemployed, lazy, can't speak English, and have no frigging clue who their daddies are. Here's what a minister in the community wrote about what he saw in this DOJ report. From police seeing African-American neighborhoods less as constituents to be protected and more as potential offenders and sources of revenue, good Lord, deliver us. From court practices that impose a particular hardship on the most vulnerable residents, especially upon those living in or near poverty, good Lord, deliver us. From police who repeatedly turn dogs exclusively against African Americans, good Lord, deliver us. Those words in the cadence of a traditional litany were written by Michael Kinman, Dean of Christ Church Episcopal Cathedral in St. Louis. We'll hear from him in a moment. But Missouri State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal also spoke with us about the challenge of seeking deliverance from the things described in the DOJ report. The 14th district Senator Chappelle Nadal represents includes the city of Ferguson.
All of the feelings that people have had in the region are absolutely valid, but we had no facts. And what information that was brought to us by the Justice Department was quite relevant in validating those feelings that people have had for a very long time. We are finally able to talk about the truth and the reality, and no one can shy away from it any longer, especially with the information that has come out from the DOJ. But I really think, even in my own experience in state government as a bureaucrat and as an elected official, we were always scared as African Americans to speak up too much because of that marginalization, which happens every day. It's systematic within institutions and also, interestingly, within our own Democratic Party. And so it's something we have to reflect on and just move forward so that we can build from this experience and know that the truth is ultimately going to allow us to have a better community.
Michael, when the revelations became public and you began to see what was in the DOJ report, how do you keep the police from suddenly being like the people who wear the badge of racism?
Well, first of all, I agree with Senator Nadal that the report did not reveal anything new to people who've been listening. It's helpful for me as a person of faith and as a faith leader to look at this, first of all, in larger concepts, but also in terms of theological issues. And the key issue here is slavery. And slavery is and always has been an economic system. And in this nation, slavery is the use of black and brown bodies to generate wealth for white people. And that means me as a white person, too. And that helps me from just pointing the finger at somebody else. Now, when I say slavery, people want to say, well, we're done with that, aren't we? But we're not. it looks different. Instead of the slave market, we have the school-to-prison pipeline. And instead of the plantation and the slave master, we have cities like Ferguson, where we have a predominantly white government, court system, and police living off the fruits of the labor of a predominantly black population and using force to extract that wealth. So if the issue is slavery, then there's a theological remedy for that. And we get into that in Genesis and Exodus. And in Genesis, we hear that all people are created in the image of God and are good. And that's when you hear the cry that Black Lives Matter, it's rooted in that theology. But then there's Exodus, which is the theology of deliverance. And we hear that God actually takes sides and speaks to Moses and says, I've observed the misery of my people. I've heard their cry. I know their sufferings. I come down to deliver them. And so the task before us is deliverance. And that means that those of us, and I say us as a white person, who are in that oppressing class, the first thing we have to do is watch and listen. We have to see the misery and hear the cry and intimately know the sufferings and come down to be with those who are in pain. But here's where Exodus is different, because Jesus teaches us that our goal is not defeating an enemy, but converting a heart. And so I could point my finger at the police and I could say, thank God I'm not like that. But as a white man, I look a lot more like Pharaoh than Moses. And so what I need to do is to look at the Department of Justice report, realize that I am someone who benefits from the sin that this reveals, which means I have sin to confess myself, and that I need to start with my own heart. And so we're being called into, our friend Tracy Blackman has said over and over again, as white America, we are being called into a prolonged period of uncomfortability, to listen deeply to these voices and be moved to change ourselves. And frankly, to change an economic system in this country, which the same way it did in 1815, benefits white people on the backs of black and brown people.
Now, Michael, that's very profound and theologically very moving, but to cast whites as the slave master in Ferguson, I don't know how reconcilable that is in terms of moving forward and having a useful police department that doesn't end up being viewed as a sort of evil institution that carries out the slave master's bidding.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think we need to recognize this is the system we have, and then we say, what are the practical steps? And one of the things we have to look at here specific to St. Louis is that we are 90 different municipalities that ring the St. Louis area, and this is not sustainable, and this perpetuates Ferguson's from happening, and Ferguson is not alone. And so there's a movement here in St. Louis called Better Together. And that's not just city and county, that is rich and poor and black and white. And we need to look at how do we dismantle the systems like the parochialism that exists in those 90 different municipalities? How do we come together and build new systems that benefit everyone? And you can't just do little technical fixes. So it's not just, well, how do we get the Ferguson Police Department to be better? No, that's not going to do it. We have to dismantle this whole system and build something new. And that's going to look, this it took us a long time to get here. It's going to take us a long time and a lot of hard work to get to where we need to go.
Senator, do we fire everybody in the Ferguson police?
I don't think that we do. I have been calling for the resignation of Chief Jackson. I also have mm-hmm. called for the disbandment of the police department. Mm-hmm. And I do agree with many people. Not every police officer is bad. But I was thinking earlier when Michael was talking, the phrases that I use are white silence and black betrayal. And there are a lot of people like Michael who have been out, who have been speaking. But I have to tell you, there are people in my own neighborhood who I've gone on long walks with who are now snubbing me on the street because they did not think that what we were fighting for was right. Now that we have the DOJ report, this is information that we can take to people who have been silent for a very long time in this process. These are also the same people who have refused to acknowledge that there is a racial problem that exists and has existed for a very long time. time. And so while we are having these conversations, a lot of people are going to be stunned and shocked that this is actually happening in their region. There is currently a tale of two cities in Ferguson and in the St. Louis region. And if we don't build that bridge, we won't be able to progress, but we have to, because we have to sustain ourselves.
That's Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal, Missouri State Senator representing Missouri's 14th district. And Michael Kinman is also with us, Dean of Christ Church Episcopal Cathedral in St. Louis. Michael, Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal is describing the difficulty of, you know, having uncomfortable conversations on the street, having strained relations with police who were friends in the midst of all of this. You evoked the book of Exodus a little while ago. And, you know, there's not a lot of forgiveness in the book of Exodus. There's a lot of Red Seas sort of, you know, dumping on people. And in a context of I told you so, which is what this Justice Department report can really be for a lot of people, how do you get to forgiveness and reconciliation?
You don't get to it by jumping too quickly. We love to talk about truth and reconciliation and look at the model of South Africa. There's a lot of truth telling that has to come before we get to reconciliation. There's a lot of deep listening that has to happen before we get to reconciliation. We have to truly hear each other. And a piece of that is building relationships. You can't be in reconciliation with someone when you're not in relationship. St. Louis is one of the top five most segregated metropolitan areas in this country and has been for a long time. We don't know each other across these lines of race and class. We can say this about racism. We can say it about solving homelessness. As long as it's an issue, we're never going to solve it because the people in power are never going to care enough. It's only going to get better. We're only going to have reconciliation when it becomes about true relationship, when it becomes not just about white people coming together with black people, but it becomes about Mike coming together with Maria. The other thing we have to do is we have to have honest conversations about the economics and the money. We've got to follow the money. And there are huge engines in the gun lobby and in the prison industry that benefit incredibly from the current situation, and that will defend the status quo because there is tons of money in it. And unless we start talking about those big money generators that have everything to benefit by keeping people of color in poverty and by keeping the policing system the way it is, it's never going to change.
Michael Kinman is Dean of Christ Church Episcopal Cathedral in St. Louis, and Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal represents Missouri's 14th district. Deliverance from mistakes of the past. What would you do if you were facing the challenges of Ferguson, Missouri and its police force in your community? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to respond to anything you heard. Tweet us at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
NASA is reminding us of just how lucky the little old Earth is. This week, by bringing the Dawn space mission to a head, the spacecraft today, after an 8-year journey, slipped into the orbit of dwarf planet Chunk Ceres that floats in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. Ceres, the remains of a planet that was destroyed in its infancy by whirling debris stirred up by the massive gravitation of Jupiter a little while ago. Pictures of Ceres have already been sent back to NASA, and they reveal tiny, bright spots that could be ice. Carol Raymond is deputy principal investigator of the Dawn mission, and she told us how the last critical piece of the mission was getting Dawn into that orbit.
It's actually not that difficult if you have the best spacecraft team in the world, which we do.
In the universe, though, I think.
In the universe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And the reason is what ion propulsion allows you to do is kind of come alongside the body. So we've been thrusting to speed up so that we can catch up with Ceres in its orbit. And then once we get close, our relative velocity is very low. And so we're basically coming in close enough that we sort of fall into Ceres orbit all the time with the brakes on, because we've been going faster than Ceres in its orbit. We put the brakes on and eventually get to a velocity and a distance in which Ceres gravity just gently lures the spacecraft into its orbit.
I'm not an expert on asteroids, but I do have a kind of layperson's sense that one looks like the other. Distinguish Ceres for me.
Ceres is the largest object in the main asteroid belt, and that, which is between Mars and Jupiter. And Ceres is a dwarf planet. It's about 600 miles in diameter, 950 kilometers, and it contains about 25% of the mass of the entire asteroid belt. So if you think about it, there's millions of objects in the asteroid belt, and it represents a quarter of the mass. So it's not a piece of collisional debris. It's an intact protoplanet, one of the building blocks of our terrestrial planets.
So being on Ceres, and the orbital spacecraft tells the tale here, is a fairly violent, over the course of celestial history, a violent tale?
It hasn't suffered an impact that has smashed it to bits, because we know it's there. It has, however, been impacted over and over again by debris. And what we're interested in looking at is the record of those impacts on Ceres surface and what they're telling us about the geologic processes. They serve to do two things. One is they excavate, they're digging under the surface and showing us what lurks below. They're also bringing localized heat, and that may drive some local geologic processes. But they're also telling us the age of surfaces, because it's kind of the analogy of bugs on a windshield. You know, the longer you drive, the more bugs will be on your windshield. And so the more craters are on the surface in any one place, the older that surface is.
The bug windshield theory. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The name of Ceres is, I think, from Greek mythology. Ceres is the god of the harvest or grains or something like that.
That's right.
Is it possible that Ceres may contain a boon, in that these surface deposits that you haven't figured out yet could be water or frozen gases that build up on something as large as Ceres?
We do expect that there is a significant amount of ice in Ceres, and we expect that that is contained in a layer that's just under the crust. And so when the ice gets exposed, it can bring different minerals and different types of materials to the surface. And we're mapping all of those variations, both the geologic features and the composition, so that we can try to infer what those processes are.
Based on the science, what would it be like to stand on this body with its nine-hour rotation?
Well, it would be hard to stand on it, because the gravity is about 0.3% of our gravity. So if you could land on the surface and stay there, then it would be a short day. It would be very cold. Kind of lonely, I guess.
And why would we want to map something on a world that we can never really go to?
Well, it's telling us the history of our solar system. I mean, it's a remnant from that very early planet-forming era, and as such, it's a time capsule. So we have various theories of how our protoplanetary disk formed and how our planets formed from that, and we need some hard data to really test some of those hypotheses and get further in our understanding of what was happening. And one, you know, mystery is, why does the Earth have so much water? Why is the Earth such a habitable planet? And a question is, did some of that water come from impacting objects from the outer solar system like Ceres? So by looking at Ceres, we're hoping we can fill in some of the blanks in some of these models and test hypotheses so that we can further our understanding of what was happening in those early periods of solar system history.
Finally, Carol, on the, I guess well-known to you, Carol Raymond scale, how excited are you?
I'm very, very excited about this, especially because we know so little about Ceres. It is so far away. The telescopes don't tell us much about it. It's also very dim. So, you know, the surface is very dark. And we haven't been able to associate any meteorites with Ceres. And that's unlike Vesta, our first target, where we had meteorites in hand in our labs that we were pretty sure came from Vesta. It turns out they did. So Ceres is a really unknown body. It's a unique body in the sense it's the only inner solar system dwarf planet. It's the only object in its category that we can go out and explore. And it's also, as you've probably seen from our initial images, got these very enigmatic features, especially these very bright spots. So it's an extremely exciting object, and I'm really looking forward to getting there and finding out what's going on.
Well, it's off the charts in the Carol Raymond excitement moment here as the deputy principal investigator of the Dawn mission anticipates the orbital success of Dawn around Ceres, the dwarf planet in the middle of the asteroid belt. Carol Raymond, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Imagine that, an ambulance in the asteroid belt. So NASA's Dawn is in the asteroid belt. Would you get on the next spacecraft bound for points outside the solar system? Brian from Portland, Oregon says, if a distant planet offered year-round snowboarding, I'd leave tomorrow.
Hi, this is Leslie Palmer from San Antonio, Texas. I don't think I'd go. While the adventure would be amazing, I rather liked my life on Earth. Being without my family, friends, dogs, work, etc., would be too much to handle, even for an opportunity of a lifetime.
You can handle calling us, though, right? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
What, it's Friday already? Oh, my goodness. Time for Movies with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Hello, folks.
Hey, hi, John.
Kind of snuck up on me there, including the releases for this week. The second best exotic Marigold Hotel. This is a sequel, yes, yes, yes?
That's right.
All right, let's hear the clip.
I'm sorry, were you talking to me?
Well, the hearing's gone then, obviously.
Yeah, along with your backbone.
I don't know why I tell you anything.
Because I'm older and wiser.
19 days older.
That's the entire lifespan of a wasp.
Oh, my goodness. Judi Dench, Maggie Smith. I can't get enough of it, but I'm a little scared of this film, Kristen.
I think you should be a little bit scared of it.
Because when I saw the first one, I didn't imagine they were thinking there was a sequel, but it did so well, so...
Exactly. I think that's what happened. And so they're trying to stretch out a story that maybe doesn't need to be stretched out. This is a retirement community in India. The proprietor of their community is Dev Patel, who's also in our other movie this week, Chappie. And we see all of these great, elite UK actors together again. And unfortunately, this time, there's not quite as much story to work with, and they're trying to stretch a story where there's not much there. It's nice spending time with these folks, but it's not really memorable, and not much happens.
I don't really think it is that nice spending time with these folks. Again, I think that's a big problem is they've made these characters...
Trapped in the Marigold Hotel would be a better title.
I think that's right. Well, yeah, the title is funny because I think what it's trying to say is another best exotic Marigold Hotel, but it always seems like second best exotic Marigold
that
Hotel to me.
Yeah, second best, yeah, right, but not something you want to put in the title.
Right,
so
you're
this
right.
This was kind of dashed off without a lot of thought.
It is, yeah.
Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, anything?
Bill Nighy, I mean, it's a great cast, amazing cast, but I mean, if you can't make good use of Bill Nighy, who's like one of the best actors around, I think you're really doing something wrong.
All right, this next film I'm very excited about. It's from the director of District 9,
yes?
That's right. Chappie.
Chappie, if you want to be in the gang, you have to be cool like Daddy. Look how Daddy walks. Look how cool he is. You need to keep a gangster.
You need to keep a gangster.
Yeah, you need to be cool.
Don't laugh, I'm being cool.
Cool. Even when you put a gun, you have to be cool like this. Boom, and you try.
No, I can't shoot people.
What?
I can't shoot them. They didn't do anything to me.
How are you going to do the heist with us if you don't shoot people?
Sounds like a reprise of the Terminator 2 scene where, you know, the Terminator is being taught the rules of how to be a human by, what's his name there? But what do you think of this?
Well, I was really excited for this film, too. I love District 9. Neil Blomkamp was the director and writer of that. Elysium was his follow-up, kind of a disappointment. And I think this film just turns out to be a complete disaster.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, you've got Charlton Copley from District 9 is playing Chappie, the robot. Hugh Jackman plays the villain. But it's a structural mess. You can't tell what's going on in any given scene. And it's no fun watching that little robot, this childlike sentient robot, being raised by what are essentially abusive parents, these horrible gangster thugs who teach him how to shoot people. It's not a very fun story. And there's something very kind of dark and cold about this worldview that also made it not that much fun to spend any time in.
All right. He's too much of a parent. It was a fabulous movie, right, Kristen?
I'm sorry, but I have to completely agree with you, Ray. For you, you are right in this case. The characters are so unlikable. The people who Chappie ends up with, I did not want to spend a single second with, and yet I felt I was trapped with them for the rest of my life. It just went on and on and on. Overly long, overly violent, and not very smart either. I feel that there must have been a kernel of something smart in there somewhere, but while I was watching it, it just felt like a hot mess.
Boy, real bad weekend we got here. So I guess we just stay home and listen to the podcast. What's
that's
on
right.
the podcast?
We are going to be talking about Tina Fey's new Netflix series,
The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
I can't wait to see that. Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer, the co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks so much, John. You too.
Tina, Frankie, I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri, and I am amazed by Stonehenge, the logistics that was involved with moving boulders of that size and positioning them in such a way, it just boggles my mind.
Right, Stonehenge. How did that happen? You would need an army of Bigfoots to raise its giant stones. Do you have a favorite place or object of mystery from ancient or modern times? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. The mother lode of ancient mysteries is what happened to the lost city of Atlantis.
Is Atlantis everything you dreamed of?
Save our planet, Justice League. They, of course, knew all about Atlantis, the lost city described by ultimate egghead Plato a long time ago. Plato, who was right about everything else, said Atlantis was lost forever, sunk to the bottom of the sea, perhaps the victim of its own tragic hubris. But Plato left out a lot of detail. And author Mark Adams, in his book Meet Me in Atlantis, tries to fill in some of that detail with the hope of stumbling onto the real evidence of Atlantis. He discovered, like many before him, that Atlantis is a journey, not a destination.
Well, everybody I spoke to, and I should say everyone who was willing to talk to me, because a lot of people, a lot of archaeologists, anthropologists, historians, they won't touch Atlantis with a 10-foot pole. It's kryptonite because it's bad for your career.
Mm-hmm.
But those who I spoke with who were willing to discuss it said, you know, find the kernel of truth in what is essentially a myth, and then you'll be able to determine how much of the story is true. And, you know, there seemed to be some historical elements. There was some sort of cataclysm, which may have been a tsunami rather than an entire island falling under the sea. There was almost certainly some sort of naval war between Athens and some other entity. And there seems to have been an actual maritime city of some sort that Plato based this on.
And the Pillars of Hercules.
Yeah, and, you know, the most famous Pillars of Hercules were, of course, the Straits of Gibraltar. And I think that's probably what Plato was referring to, although other people have different theories. And as you look at all the various Atlantis theories, you notice that people tend to bend the evidence in the direction of the location that they've chosen for the possible site.
Who were the most famous sort of, you know, believers that they'd found Atlantis? And do you think they were crackpots, or do you think they were well-meaning anthropologists of another era?
Well, it depends. You can go all the way back to, you know, Plato founded the first university, the Academy in Athens. And one of the second generations that came after Plato died, a fellow named Crantor, a famous commentator on Plato's dialogue, he believed it was real. For a long time, the idea of Atlantis died out. And then in the 19th century, a fellow named Ignatius Donnelly, who was kind of a crackpot, he was a U.S. Congressman from Minnesota, you know, he found some of the first scientific data about mountain ridges on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean and used that to make these incredible extrapolations about Atlantis having been in the Atlantic, which is why most people, if you ask them right now where was Atlantis, they'd say it was in the Atlantic Ocean.
Why do you think Plato spent so much time on Atlantis? I mean, there's certainly some evidence that Plato loved to play practical mathematical jokes on his students. And if we're to believe that he's done this to all of civilization, there's one smart guy.
Well, the thing about Plato is we're still figuring some of these things out. And what initially attracted me about Atlantis was that the story appears between the Republic, which is arguably the most influential work in Western civilization, and the Timaeus, which is Plato's attempt to explain the universe and one of the most influential books, certainly in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, hugely influential on everything from physics to Christianity. In between those two works, you've got the story of Atlantis. So obviously it meant something to Plato. Exactly what it meant, I don't think we can tell. As best as I can guess, it's sort of a story that invites you to engage with his philosophy. It's sort of a crack in the door to suck you into some stuff that is really not easy to wrap your head around.
Or we interrupt these two chapters in the most brilliant philosophy in all human history to present some balderdash.
It's possible. But, you know, why would Plato insert it at the beginning of the Timaeus, which is a very, very important work to him? To me, it doesn't make any sense. Also, he repeatedly says, and we have to figure out whether he's being serious or not, you know, this is a true story, this is a true story, this is a true story. Whether he is, you know, saying that ironically, we can't tell from this vantage point.
You know, Plato is a crazy kind of character. I mean, if you try to glean what it must have been like to be one of his students, I mean, there are places in the dialogues where he actually believes that reading is awful.
Yeah.
And in fact, that if civilization adopts reading, it's headed for disaster.
Well, this is a time when written history is basically a new technology, and that's part of the story as well. You know, I mean, Socrates in another dialogue says, you know, I don't believe in writing because you can't argue with it. And the question about Atlantis is this something that was passed down as oral history? You know, Plato says he got it from an esteemed ancestor who was, you know, Solon, who was kind of like the Thomas Jefferson of Athens, who got it from hieroglyphics in Egypt. Does that mean it was passed down as oral history, or did he just make that up because he thought it was a good story? And up to this point, there have been two opinions on Atlantis. He either made it up or it's all true. If you believe it's all true, you're crazy. If you believe he made it up, you probably a tenured professor somewhere. You know, the truth probably lies somewhere in between. He made some of it up, and some of it was actually based in oral history that was passed down to him. That's part of the whole argument that Socrates makes in the other work. It's, in the Republic, he says, aren't there stories that are true and stories that are false? Well, what if there are stories that are part true and part false?
The truth lies somewhere in the middle. What do you believe? What do you believe?
What do I believe? I believe.
What do you believe?
I believe there is a kernel of truth in the Atlantis story.
So
I don't think
there's some jug somewhere, some pillar, some crumbled building somewhere.
Wouldn't that be amazing? Can you imagine if they found some sort of inscription? And like I said, all of this supposedly comes back all the way back from Egypt. What if they found some inscription, you know, in the Valley of the Kings or something? I mean, it would be the biggest news of the year. It would be like there is some sort of proof of Atlantis. Every time even the smallest little, you know, even hint of Atlantis, they found some orichalcum, you know, a few weeks ago. This was in the news. Somebody found some metal in the Mediterranean that might possibly have some sort of relation to the metal that Plato mentions was in Atlantis. You know, if they could find that plus a three-ringed city in the Mediterranean, I think we would have a very strong indication that there's a lot of truth in this story.
Look at you. You've got the bug.
It's a virus, man.
Oh, that's great. Mark Adams, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Adams is the author of the new book, Meet Me in Atlantis. It would be amazing to find tangible evidence of the city of Atlantis, find some sign that says, Welcome to Atlantis, home of Bigfoot. At the end of the hour, though, here's something to take with you, or maybe for the whole week. You can cross this off your persistent mystery list. A year after the disappearance of MH370, the New York Times reports that the former chief pilot for Malaysia Airlines says that he is convinced human intervention was to blame. Human intervention. Well, that explains everything. Tell us what you think about persistent mysteries in your life or in our lives. 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry. Or check us out at thetakeaway.org, where the conversation always is continuing. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at shopkeep.com. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. The new comedy directed by John Madden, starring Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nye, Dev Patel, and Richard Gere. In theaters everywhere now.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.